and we watch Spider-Man and Superman and Heroes That Fly. And I speak for myself, most of the time when I was a kid, I would go on something high or on the beds, and then I jump pretending to be Superman or you know, one of these characters that flies. Mm-hmm. So I pretend to fly. Or I, you know, when we play, we act as we are, you know, doing something that is, you know, as we say, خارق للعادة, something out of
supernatural,
out of this world. So our minds have these visions, right? And we act them outside. Why? Because it takes effect on us. Most parents, for example, once they see their kids trying to act things, what do? They tell them off. Stop doing that. You know, don't jump on the bed. Don't jump on the couch. Don't do this. You know, they kill that acting process in the heads of becoming who they want to become. Because this is acting something in the outside is actually being creative.
Yeah.
When you stop them, you kill their creativity. So the Prophet sallallahu alaihi wasallam in the hadith, he says, if the child is playing, he says tasabu ma'ah, like play with him, right?
Play
so play along with him. So if your son wants to think that he's a superhero, you lift him up and make him fly, right? Enact that process of flying. That gives him encouragement. That gives him, you know, makes his personality stronger. It makes him believe in himself more. He would have more self-esteem, right? So you're building his personality through enacting the things that he likes.
Mm-hmm.
So the Prophet sallallahu alaihi wasallam says tasabu ma'ah, meaning you become a child with him. Meaning what? Whatever you know that is logic, leave it in a drawer and become a child. That's what tasabi means. You need to become a child yourself.
Mm-hmm.
How does it feel? Like if I go back in time, how does it feel for me to be a child?
Wonderful.
I would go crazy, right? I would play, I would jump, I'd do... This is what this is what I do with my kids. I bring myself to their level. For example, I pretend I'm their horse, and I put them on my back, and I run around.
Don't
right?
we all, yeah.
Yeah, so that to the child, it creates a sense of, like I said, strength, a sense of creativity, a sense of belief in themselves, a sense of, you know, even that bond between a son and a father, or a son and a mother, or children and their parents becomes a lot stronger through the process of acting things. So
we
acting
we used
is
to
important.
Call this pretending when we were kids. It's the same concept, right?
You pretend to be someone else, but in reality is an action. You're acting, right?
Yeah.
So I'm an acting by pretending to be. Even Superman and all these heroes themselves, they're pretending to be them through the process of acting.
Well, that's new information.
Yeah.
And you can tap into this imagination. It's very, very strong, has a lot of potential. I mean, I remember that my siblings, used to have a trouble with them to encourage them to, you know, to convince them to wear a coat in winter. So we would have to tap into their imagination. Look, you're the princess.
Yeah.
This is your dress and you have to wear it. It always works. Actually, and they love it.
Yeah, let me tell you something funny. I'm not sure if we have enough time. Quickly, there's a clip on YouTube where there's people, like grown-up men, they're trying to be Goku from Dragon Ball Z, that cartoon.
Yeah.
And you know Dragon Ball Z, in the cartoon, he goes Kamehameha and he gets fire out of his head.
Yeah.
And there were literally men on YouTube trying to, they think they can do what Goku does. And they have their hands stuck together and they go Kamehameha as long as their lungs could withstand.
So they were not pretending.
They're not pretending.
Okay.
You know? So it, you know, so the more you think you put yourself in that state, it might work.
All right. Thank you very much. That's a nice place to end this program. Unfortunately, we're out of time, but if you missed it, don't worry. You can always download an archive of this episode and our previous episodes from our website. Simply visit www.parstoday.com. That's parstoday.com. Find the Call of Islam link and we'll be right there, Islamic Upbringing. You can email us at englishradio@irib.ir. That's englishradio@irib.ir. And you can find us on various social media applications. Simply search Call of Islam Radio on Twitter, Instagram, Telegram, or YouTube. Until next episode, Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Islam solves all of its problems. Allah leaves no stone unturned, perfect with no flaws at all, are the laws of Allah. A way of life, a way of life, a way of life, a way
reporters.
Hezbollah Secretary General Said Hassan Nasrallah began his televised speech by denouncing the U.S. administration's decision to seize and block dozens of website domains connected to Iranian and regional media outlets.
It's not coincidental that these websites which were seized are media outlets that had a major role in supporting the Palestinians in the Sword of Al-Quds battle. They all have a clear position from the Zionist enemy and the American hegemony over the region. These outlets are critical of sedition and terrorism, specifically Takfiri terrorism. This gives us and the free people of the world another piece of evidence against the false claims of the U.S. administration, which claims to defend freedom of speech and freedom of opinion.
Said Nasrallah also criticized U.S. statements that attempt to incite the Lebanese army against the resistance. Said Nasrallah noted that U.S. officials have tried to justify their humble support to the Lebanese army by stressing that this assistance is aimed at giving the army leverage to confront Hezbollah. This, Said Nasrallah says, will not happen since the National Army is the main guarantor for peace in the country. On another note, the resistance leader explained how Hezbollah has been exerting an effort to mediate talks for the formation of the cabinet.
All efforts in the country must come together to form a government and to pull the country out of this dilemma. Since Prime Minister-designate Saad Hariri was named by most members of parliament, we have been working on a quick formation of the cabinet. We have been supportive of an initiative from Speaker Berry, and we will work on finding resolutions to the last few disagreements in the talks.
Experts believe Said Nasrallah's words and sufferings of the people lining up at gas stations and pharmacies should be an incentive for the officials to find solutions.
Said Nasrallah said there is no magical solution, and he stressed that the crisis should be disintegrated and resolved one by one until the government is reestablished. If we want to go back to the state where the government collects taxes and the citizens practice their rights and responsibilities in paying taxes, where there are investments in the country again and we create more job opportunities, all of these issues need political stability, and political stability will be the only first step to genuinely solve the many crises in the country.
Said Nasrallah has stressed that Hezbollah has accomplished all the administrative and logistic preparations for importing gasoline and fuel from Iran to Lebanon in case the state fails to cover the fuel shortage. Maryam Saleh, Beirut.
Luxurious Avonfield apartments located at Park Lane, Mayfair in London. The family of thrice-elected former Prime Minister of Pakistan, Nawaz Sharif, has been staying here for decades. A trial court sentenced Nawaz Sharif for 10 years in 2018 for owning these flats, which the judge found were purchased through money laundering and ill-gotten money. Sharif left Pakistan in late 2019 after being released, allegedly on the basis of false medical reports, to once again reside in this palatial residence. To the shock of the former Prime Minister, back in Pakistan, now a high court set aside his appeal and upheld the verdict of the trial court. Sharif was declared a fugitive of law by the court when he backtracked his commitment with the high court to return home within a few weeks after the medical treatment. This has now led High Court to reject his appeal for failing to return home despite his earlier pledge with the court.
I think Nawaz Sharif should not have fled the country and now that he has been declared as fugitive or an absconder, that's not good for him. That will actually soil his political reputation. For now, you know, Nawaz Sharif is in trouble and politically, I think, his position has become more precarious.
The High Court verdict has come as a major political victory for ruling party of Prime Minister Imran Khan, who came into power in 2018 with the pledge to prosecute Nawaz Sharif and other opposition leaders on corruption charges.
This verdict is a victory for the people of Pakistan, and this verdict is the victory to the ruling party's anti-corruption campaign. We believe Nawaz Sharif must return the money he looted from the people of Pakistan.
The former Prime Minister still has one chance to appeal with the Supreme Court of Pakistan to set aside his conviction. But for that to happen, Sharif must return home Otherwise, legal experts believe that the top court may also reject his appeal. Javed Rana, Islamabad.
Shocking footage filmed on the 18th of June, Iran's election day, shows Iranian expats being attacked outside polling stations up and down the UK. Victims included women and the elderly, the perpetrators, supporters of anti-Iran terrorist groups, including the MEK, communists, and Shah royalists.
Videos released on social media show fanatic protesters hurling Islamophobic abuse and even physically assaulting voters in cities including Birmingham, Manchester, and here in London too.
One victim reached out to tell us about her ordeal.
As soon as I got near the embassy, I was wearing the hijab, obviously, and the crowd started roaring and screaming, and they got louder as they saw me, obviously, going to vote. Calling me names, calling my family names, cursing my mother, my father. I heard a rock hit the ground. I didn't look back because I was shaking at that time as well. One of them said to me, and funnily enough, the policeman was there, but obviously he couldn't understand Farsi. Was telling me if I had a knife, I would cut you in pieces right here, right now. I was so shaking with fear. Since then, I've suffered with anxiety since that day. I said to myself, I should have left. But I stood my ground. I said, why should I leave? And the people coming, I said, why are you calling me names? They said, we call you names because you deserve it.
Britain boasts about being a defender of democracy on the world stage. But these violent scenes suggest that the UK failed miserably to protect democratic rights of Iranians inside its own borders. Despite these attempts, Iran's election went ahead with President-elect Sayed Ibrahim Raisi coming out on top. Robert Carter, London.
It's the world's second most populous nation, and the figures of COVID-19 infection cases are rising on a daily basis. The cities are bustling as the country is picking up pace as the world's fastest growing major economies. But in all this hustle bustle and race of survival, an important aspect of life is on stake, and that is mental health. The second wave of COVID-19 has altered the lifestyle of millions across India who now are struggling in silence. Reports suggest more than 70% of those in the age group of 18 to 24 are suffering from some form of depression. Now, the COVID-19 pandemic has ignited the crisis further, as many are facing financial and social hardships. According to psychological experts, economic and social pressures combined with a lack of appropriate mental health facilities is a major reason behind this new epidemic, which has now started exploding due to the coronavirus pandemic. Based on reports, the economic cost of mental illness in India is expected to be more than $1 trillion by 2030.
COVID-19 has impacted a lot. A lot means, you can say, almost everyone, because one or the other way, everyone has been affected, whether it's, the infection has caused or the mental health or the other ways, because the businesses has shut down.
Health experts say all disorders are linked to a fast-paced lifestyle, stress, complexities of living, breakdown of support systems, and challenges of economic instability. They say the COVID pandemic has added fuel to the fire with depression, anxiety disorders, schizophrenia, psychotic disorders, and substance abuse being common in most people.
One must go for yoga daily. Yoga, you have to do proper yoga. Then breathing exercises are there. They have to do at least half an hour to 1 hour so that the blood circulation towards brain increases.
COVID-19 lockdowns impacted people from all walks of life and age groups. Now they're finding it hard to deal with consequences of the pandemic-induced lockdowns. Many turn to drugs and alcohol, while others prefer religious therapies and yoga. Munawar Zaman, New Delhi.
Britain Britain's travel industry is frustrated and nervous. Protesting around the country on June 23rd, people whose jobs rely on international travel, now only working at 10% capacity. They want more countries on the so-called green list to save jobs.
It just doesn't make a lot of sense. And then why put some on the green list and then take them off? Like, say we booked a holiday to Portugal. We were supposed to be there this week and we've cancelled it because it went amber and it was going to cost another £1,000 in COVID tests.
The restrictions are now crazy. So I'm stuck in London, in England for quite a long time. And I wish to travel back to my country as I haven't seen my mom for 2 years.
Green means arrivals to the UK do not need to self-isolate, but have to take a test before and after they travel. Amber means self-isolating at home for up to 10 days, and red means quarantining at a hotel paid for by the travelers.
In the past few days, some government officials suggested double-jabbed passengers from amber-list countries could be exempt from quarantining.
We're also looking to see how we can replace the protections that are currently there with the restrictions with protections that come from the vaccine with respect to international travel as well, but it is more difficult freeing up international travel.
And difficult it will be when it comes to the willingness of other countries to let British tourists in. Germany has called on all EU countries to make British travelers quarantine on arrival to slow the spread of the Delta variant. All this as the UK recorded more than 16,000 new COVID cases Wednesday, the highest figure since early February, most of them caused by the Delta variant first discovered in India. There were also 19 deaths. The travel industry is yet to react to the government announcement, but with countries moving up and down the UK government's list, British travelers have to think again before they take a gamble. Saeed Puriza, London.
As anti-Westminster sentiment continues to rise, another part of Britain is entering the fight to break away from the UK. Cornwall, located on the southwest of the island, is witnessing the start of a new pro-independence advocacy group which aims to revive a lesser-known campaign for Cornish independence.
All Under One Banner's Cur Now is the latest branch in a wider organisation which already has roots in Scotland and Wales. In both countries, All Under One Banner has achieved significant success in opening up the debate on independence. Locals in Cornwall are hoping to achieve the same.
Many Cornish people, who are recognised as a Celtic minority, have various grievances with the English-centric London rule, including a lack of funding and a systematic destruction of an ancient culture.
That's a good way of explaining it. We're a long colonised place, possibly longer than the Welsh, who also probably feel that they've been colonised as well. But we've recovered that history, and that's one of our greatest successes. And the greatest challenge now is decolonising the history and explaining it to Anglo-Saxon ears.
In past campaigns, activists have been branded as nationalists who hate the English, a claim rejected by locals.
I've got no problem with the English or with any other nationality at all. What I have a problem with is the way that possibly we are represented through them, and the way sometimes we are talked down to and treated by them. But no, there's no problem at all. We have so many friends from all over the world down here.
For now, Cornish independence is a minority view, but lifelong campaigners believe things are changing.
I think we're already getting there in terms of greater autonomy, understanding the need for it. The next question is how to get it, and obviously there are political ways of getting it, but there's also a need for people to go out and campaign for it.
The idea of Scotland or Wales breaking away has sent shivers down Number 10. This latest development in Cornwall will surely only worsen Downing Street's fears. Robert Carter, London.
Mm-hmm.
The US Justice Department committed a new flagrant violation of the freedom of the press and blocked several regional outlets' websites, including the Yemeni channel Al Masira and Iran's Press TV, claiming they are linked to what it calls Iranian disinformation efforts. Yemenis condemned this move, saying it proves that the US calls for freedom of speech are lies.
The seizure of some of the websites affiliated with the resistance front comes amid the media war. The Saudi-led coalition has been trying since the beginning of its war on Yemen to cover up its crimes committed against Yemenis and to mislead world public opinion.
Yemen's Ministry of Information said the U.S. government seizure of a few websites confirmed the strength of the media of the resistance and proved that these websites revealed the true face of the U.S., including its participation in the brutal Saudi war on Yemen.
We condemn the seizure of some websites affiliated with the resistance front. This move shows that these websites have been strong enough to influence the American public opinion by releasing the realities on the ground. It reveals the falsehood of American claims about democracy and freedom of speech. Certainly, there are solutions to this blocking, and the websites will be running again.
Ali Ashrai, the manager of Al Masira website, said this move revealed the weakness of the U.S., even though it owns thousands of media outlets.
This step reveals the great weakness that the United States is suffering from, even though it owns thousands of websites, satellite channels, newspapers, and radio stations. However, it was unable to withstand a few channels with limited capabilities which convey the truth as it is and express the opinion of the free people in this world.
Experts believe that this step is part of a media war of the U.S. government against the media outlets of the resistance. They said these attacks will persist and the resistance access should be ready for further violations.
Yemenis say the freedom of speech is a fundamental right for all free people of the world, and the United States has no right to deny individuals or communities this right. They believe that such attacks will promote the free media outlets to continue exposing the U.S. policies. Abdul Latif Al-Washali, Sana'a.
A number of Palestinian prisoners are going on with an open-ended hunger strike to protest their illegal imprisonment without charge or trial under Israel's so-called administrative detention. At least three prisoners insist to continue their strike despite their seriously deteriorating condition until Israel releases them. Among them is 28-year-old Ghadanfar Abu Atwan, who has started his hunger strike almost 50 days ago. After starting his strike, Israel's prison authorities placed him in isolation. Later, he was transferred to Kaplan Medical Center south of Tel Aviv because of his serious illness, and he's being held there under detention.
Of course, when all doors are shut down in the face of the prisoners to get rid of the administrative detention, they have few means to protest and they have to engage in the hunger strike battle, especially that many prisoners' terms are renewed for several times and this without charge or trial. When Ghadanfar started his protest, he was beaten and tortured by the Israeli jailers and he was held in solitary confinement.
Palestinians held a protest in solidarity with the prisoners outside the Red Cross Committee building in Ramallah. The oldest of those taking part is 59-year-old, a senior leader of the Hamas movement, Jamal Tawil, joined in protest over the detention of his daughter, journalist Bushra Tawil. He's demanding Israeli authorities to release him and his daughter. Israeli court had extended Bushra's previous administrative detention order last March. There is also Sheikh Khadr Adnan, prominent leader of the jihad movement, whom is staging his fifth hunger strike. This is the 12th time he has been detained.
Today we are here not only to stand by the prisoners and support them. This is the least we can do against the administrative detention policy. Israel arrests people from all walks of life and different political spectrum. We are in real need to launch a national and worldwide campaign to force Israel to stop this policy that exposes the Israeli authorities and their illegal practices.
The Palestinian Prisoners Society said the Israeli authorities have lately increased the use of administrative detention against Palestinians. The committee said Israeli authorities issued 200 administrative detention orders since the beginning of May. The majority of the hunger-striking prisoners are those who are held arbitrarily under Israel's policy of administrative detention. That's why they put their lives on the line to demand not only their freedom, but an end to the administrative detention policy. Mona Kandil, occupied Ramallah.
The U.S. Special Envoy for North Korea visited South Korea for talks with both his South Korean and Japanese counterparts. Sung Kim then repeated Washington's desire for dialogue with Pyongyang.
Most importantly, we reaffirmed our two countries' shared commitment to pursuing the complete denuclearization of the Korean Peninsula through diplomacy and dialogue. We took note of the recent statement out of Pyongyang regarding their preparation for dialogue, and we hope to receive a positive response to our proposal for a meeting soon.
U.S. President Joe Biden's new point man on North Korea, however, conditioned any negotiations on U.S.-led sanctions against North Korea remaining in place, which many see as a barrier to kickstarting broader denuclearization talks. Some activists suggest the tension provides the U.S. an excuse to deploy troops to the region and support American weapons producers.
The importance of the Korean Peninsula has increased as the U.S. military pressure and response to China has been strengthened. The traditional diplomatic and security establishment of the U.S. wants to maintain a certain level of conflict on the Korean Peninsula.
North Korean leader Kim Jong-un last week told officials at a party meeting to be prepared for both dialogue and confrontation. Pyongyang later responded to Washington's offer of talks with ridicule, suggesting a wrong interpretation would lead to disappointment. The U.S. may be paying more attention to North Korea with the appointment of a special envoy in his five-day visit here to South Korea. The question is whether that will translate into greater flexibility from Washington in terms of offering Pyongyang some sanctions relief as North Korea deals with the COVID-19 pandemic and recent natural disasters. Frank Smith, Seoul.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
Cronyism and outsourcing have defined the British government's response to the pandemic. From the VIP lane for personal protective equipment, PPE suppliers, with connections to the Tory party, to the privatized track and trace system so flawed, it was described by Sage as only being of marginal impact. Dear listeners, this was part of an article written by Andrew Fisher Ryder. This article is published under the heading NHS is being privatized by stealth under cover of a pandemic. Stay tuned for more. Cronyism and outsourcing have defined the British government's response to the pandemic. From the VIP lane for personal protective equipment, PPE suppliers, with connections to the Tory party, to the privatized track and trace system so flawed, it was described by Sage as only being of marginal impact. But less attention has been paid to what the longer-term impact of these decisions might be. Far from being an aberration, the government's pandemic response reflects its commitment to embedding private interests at the heart of the state and stealthy chipping away at Most Valued National Institution. As Sir David King, a former chief scientific advisor and the special representative for climate change under Boris Johnson when he was foreign secretary, recently told The Guardian, the government is slipping through plans to effectively privatize the NHS by stealth in the name of a pandemic. This story of privatization is not one of the wholesale transfers, such as the sell-off of British Gas or Royal Mail, but rather of a gradual hollowing out, a process that has been further accelerated by the pandemic and will continue under the Johnson government. In 2010, for example, the NHS spent £4.1 billion on private sector contracts. By 2019, this had more than doubled to £9.2 billion. Already, the government's pandemic response is shaping the future structures of the NHS, public procurement and public scrutiny. Look at PPE procurement, which has functioned recently as a giant slush fund for Tory donors. The charity says these red flags require more, not less, scrutiny. But less scrutiny is precisely what the government has been engineering. Ministers are still refusing to publish the full list of companies that were placed in the VIP lane after being endorsed by politicians or senior civil servants. The Register of Ministers' Financial Interest, which should be published every 6 months, was last updated 9 months ago. Basic avenues of accountability and transparency are consistently being closed down or obstructed. Journalists have found freedom of information requests delayed or blocked by the clearinghouse unit set up in the Cabinet Office to screen requests, while leaked emails show the Cabinet Office is collating lists of journalists with details about their work and intervening when sensitive subjects are inquired about. Meanwhile, the role of overseeing the ministerial code was left vacant for 5 months after Sir Alex Allen resigned when Johnson opted not to sack Patel for breaching the code last November. His replacement, Christopher Gate, will still not be able to initiate investigations into improperty without the Prime Minister's approval. These instances reflect a dilution of oversight that bots ill for the future. Scaling back scrutiny and accountability are vital ways of providing cover for further NHS privatization, a policy ministers know to be politically unpopular. Another way of doing this is through the creation of new bodies, spearheaded by figures who are compliant with the sensitive to do this government agenda. Hanok had sought to replace Public Health England PHE with the National Institute for Health Protection. The consulting firm McKinsey was paid £560,000 for 5 weeks' work drawing up plans for the new body. Dido Harding, who sits in the House of Lords as a Tory peer, was initially chosen to head the new body, an appointment that Lord Falconer termed a corruption of British Constitution. After backlash against the government's attempts to subsume public health experts under track and trace management, NIHP will now become the UK Health Security Agency, UKHSA, headed by Dr. Jenny Harris. Understandably, the creation of UKHSA and abolition of PHE has upset dedicated public professionals across the health service. Another policy decision that may strengthen the cronies' approach adopted during the pandemic is the Health and Social Care White Paper, which was published in February this year and spun as a set of policies that would unravel Andrew Lansing's 2012 Health and Social Care Act. The white paper sets out how Integrated Care Systems, ICS, will be rolled out, combining NHS Trust with GP services as commissioners from a single budget pot. These ICS bodies will no longer be required to put contracts out to tender, but can instead award them directly, creating opportunities for contracts to be awarded to politically connected firms. The campaigning think tank We Own It is concerned that these plans would embed the role of the private sector within the health service, but with less transparency and accountability over contracts. Indeed, GP services are an area where the private sector is taking an increasing interest, with U.S. health giants such as Centene Corporation buying up GP services through its UK arm, Operos Health. Campaigners are worried these ICS bodies will be unaccountable and profit-making, and that private providers could sit on their commissioning boards. It's not yet clear whether ICS board meetings will be public and subject to FOI requests. It's not just GP services that are an area of concern. In August last year, the government announced a four-year plan to spend £10 billion of taxpayers' money on private hospitals in order to clear NHS waiting list. This has been justified as an emergency measure to deal with a backlog. But the question remains why this money was used to fund private providers rather than NHS capacity. The health campaigner John Lister says the institutionalized use of private hospitals will likely leave the NHS weakened and could lead to long-term expansion of the private sector for elective care. This points to the core of the issue. Though ministers have sought to justify their decisions with reference to the exceptional circumstances of COVID-19, many of these decisions instead seem part of a longer-term plan to embed political appointees and private providers at the heart of the state. Rather than selling off the NHS outright, a decision politicians know would be unpopular. They are instead doing this through the back door, by stealth.
Start.
Movement.
Speed.
Live in hope.
Toward the pit.
On Youth Station.
I am a Muslim. Islam ID. Allah my Lord.
His word Quran.
Muhammad Prophet.
Praise be upon.
I am Muslim for all of time.
Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners. You're listening to IRIB English Radio. This is Youth Station Choo Choo Kachoo. It's the Youth Station for you. I'm your host, Muzaffar Haider, and here in the studio today we have with us Brother Mahdi Najafi.
Assalamu alaikum, everyone who's with us, who isn't with us, and who's going to join us, and who's never going to join us.
We're going to take a trip down philosophy lane today. So we're talking about the trueness of our beliefs. There are many beliefs that we have which turn out to be untrue, and there are many beliefs that we don't have, and those turn out to be true. And there are beliefs and trueness to them. My point is, Brother Matthew,
the listeners just tuned off.
I think the listeners have. It's all right. We're gonna bring this back down to earth, inshallah. But the point is, how do we recognize the trueness of beliefs? How? You have a belief, for example. How do you know it's true? There is that idea, right? That it's everything's just an objective reality. everybody's belief is true partially, and everybody's there is no real fact, there's no real absolute truth.
My belief, what do you mean? For example, I believe that that person does not have a good thought about me. Are you talking about those beliefs, or are you talking about like the faith beliefs?
Yeah, people have faith in so many different things. There's superstitions, for example. People think that if a black cat crosses you from in front, then it's going to be bad luck for you. Some people think that if you walk under a ladder, for example, something terrible will happen. And then there's religious ideas which are completely wrong, like the Trinity, the Father, the Son, and the Holy Ghost. They believe that God is three but one, but three but one, but three but one. And so they go into this endless spiral.
I think that rooted from something very pure, you know.
Of course, everything
that rooted from something.
Every thought can
like
go back.
You know,
to
I think like
the purity of God.
The people who actually accepted Trinity, they were very close to Tawheed. They were very close to Tawheed, and the way it was explained to them, they probably misinterpreted the true definition that was given to them.
Mm-hmm,
you know,
mm-hmm.
Because we do have something like that in Islam. Right, that for example, you know why they say because when what they say is why Jesus Christ is God is because he is the name of God, you know, the name of God, and for example, why the Holy Spirit is of God is because it's the power of God, and the power and the names of God are not different to God himself,
mm-hmm.
yet hence they're God, right.
Mm-hmm.
The result that they came out with, the outcome or how they perceived it ultimately might not be so correct, but the foundation that they had is very true.
Well, the foundation was Tawheed. Every prophet came to teach his people about Tawheed, the oneness of God, and that can be said about every religion, even Hinduism. It can be said about every pagan religion that existed throughout history.
Mm.
Just the Christians, however, many of them, unfortunately, do believe that that Jesus is the begotten Son of God, which is completely and entirely false. It's completely changed the reality of God itself.
Yeah, well, that's what I'm saying. I was recently reading how they come up with that theory that he's begotten, and by begotten, that's what they mean, apparently. Like, I'm not gonna speak out of for every Christian out there who believes in Trinity. I'm just talking about the place I read it.
Mm-hmm.
Was that to beget? They mean that because it's him and his names. He's part of his names, which is why he is not different. And this is what you have in Islam. Let me elaborate. Allah Subhanahu wa Taala's names and his traits and his power is not different to himself. Everything that he has, his traits, his names, and his power, is entirely himself. You know. So if that's what was told to these people who believed in Trinity, and that's how they came out with Trinity, as we said, the foundation was okay, but you know, by begetting and naming him.
Well, I mean, as the Christians themselves say, the path to God is paved with good intentions. Maybe people did have good intentions, but
the path to God is paved with good intentions.
Yeah, I mean, it's said in a slightly different way, but yeah, the path to the path to hell is paved with good intentions, as the Christians themselves say.
Yeah,
we come back to that though. We're going to go for a short break.
This is IRIB English Radio. You're listening to Youth Station.
So, but bringing it back now, how do you recognize whether your beliefs are true? How? How do you recognize the trueness of your thought? You do know. It's very simple. So, the Shia school of thought, particularly, Islam generally, and the Shia school of thought particularly, is very, very heavy on the use of logic, our brains, our capacity to think, to contemplate, to reason, rationality. In fact, Islam teaches us that you're not allowed to believe in anything until you have rationally come to a logical conclusion about that.
Yeah, but someone's rationale is completely different to another person's. That's a problem we have in society.
No, it's not. Some people may be lacking in rationality.
Yeah.
But rationality itself dictates that there is one evident truth. So, for example, there might be two people who are arguing about God, right? One of them insists on the Trinity. The other one says it doesn't make sense. And this is often what happens. And I heard this from Brother Anthony, our good friend, who used to be a Christian. He's now a Muslim. He was actually training to be a Christian priest. And so he goes and he says, look, Father, this is not making sense to me. You're saying that God is three but one, but three but one. And so he was told, you just have to believe. You just have to believe. There's no logical foundation behind it, really. And this applies across the board, whether it's worshipping Ganesh and Brahman and, you know, all the different gods in Hinduism, or back in the day, you know, Thor or Zeus or any of these ideas, the god of fertility during ancient Egyptian times.
Well, you know, there's a god of coronavirus.
Oh, is there?
Yeah.
That's the first time I'm hearing it, but it would make perfect sense. The mentality throughout history seems to have been to submit and worship whatever is dangerous, which made it very easy for the British to come and colonialize the entire place because it enforced this submissiveness, right? Yeah, but yeah, it comes down to logic. If you can logically and rationally dissect your thoughts.
Yeah, and as I said at the beginning of the program, if you mean by beliefs, what do you mean by beliefs? Like, is it religious strictly, or is it general beliefs? For example,
any belief. I'll posit the claim here that any beliefs. If you want to differentiate between true beliefs and false beliefs, you have to go and look at it logically.
All right. So, but how do I understand the logic of everything? Because not everyone has gone and studied logic to be able to be in this. To understand that, yeah, this is logical and it's not logical.
True. I mean, they may not have studied, Greek logic, and they might not have studied the depths of it, but every human being has the capacity to understand the biggest and most important and most fundamental aspect of the reality of life, the universe and everything, which is God. I'll give you an example. Remember the Ajuz, the old lady? The Holy Prophet sallallahu alaihi wa alayhi, he goes to this old lady and he says, do you believe in God? And she says, yes, absolutely. He says, why do you believe in God? And she's spinning this, they used to spin this wheel in order to get their work done.
Right,
the grinder.
Seeds.
Or, you know, they used to spin the spinning wheel.
Mm-hmm.
And she says, the only way that this turns is if I move it. So how can this entire universe be in motion if it does not have a turner? So even her, from her limited understanding, could arrive at the ultimate reality. The only hindrance, by the way, between one and finding Allah, or at least arriving at the basic premise of the existence of Allah, is stubbornness, is desire, is lust, is attachment to the dunya.
Do you agree with this, that if I hold on to something that I know for certain, not that something I believe, right? There's a difference between believing something and knowing something. So if I hold on to something that I know is for sure and is certain, then I do not hold on to it as firmly as I would to something. I would not hold on firmly to something that is not known for me, right? I might be inclined towards that, but I do not know it for sure. So I let that go, and I hold on to something that I know. This is how I can find out if something that I would believe is true or it's not. Is that true?
I think what you're talking about is the difference between knowing something and absolutely knowing something, like yaqeen.
There's one thing that I absolutely know something, I hold on to that. Other things that might not be so certain for me, and I just let them go.
Hold on to that one thing that you know until you absolutely know it. Yes, there's an ethos. This is the ethos of Islam, right?
Right.
worship your Lord until you, absolutely, or serve your Lord until you arrive at absolute certainty.
What's that absolute certainty? Because, you know,
you have to first know that your Lord exists and that you can worship him.
Yeah, absolutely. Right. That's
that
what
basic thing needs to be there. And you can only arrive at that through logic.
Right. So, so that's what you mean. Like, no, there's two types of knowing. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, yeah.
So you know that there's a Lord, but then there's another kind of knowing. What do you mean?
Yeah, there is. Okay, so there's levels of belief. One of them is you see the signs. Let's describe it with a fire, right?
That's a beautiful one.
Right, it's a beautiful one, right? So first you can see the smoke. You see the smoke, and therefore you know that there's a fire. But then you get closer, and you see the fire itself. This is another level of certainty. Yes, there is definitely a fire there. Then you get closer, and you feel the heat of the okay, now this fire is real. Definitely real. It's there.
Yeah.
Then the last stage is when you're burning in the fire. That there is, like, it you've felt it now. There's no denying it. So definitely there is gradability to knowing something. Mm. And logic can take you to a certain place, and thereafter, you know, you have
to... Yeah, the definition of logic in itself is that it takes you from things that you know in your mind, you know, the information that you have, to things that are unknown, mm-hmm, to your mind, using that information that is in your mind. Right. So that's how you define logic.
Yeah.
You know?
And people who have beliefs without going through that logical process, actually contemplating about it, don't actually have those beliefs. They're just ideas that they might proclaim that they have, but they haven't actually arrived at it themselves, and therefore...
So one word answer to the question that you asked. Logic?
I'd say logic, yeah.
All right.
Yeah. How do you differentiate between the trueness of what you believe in and the fakeness of what you believe in? Logic. Think about it. That's all we have time for today. We hope that you enjoyed and benefited from the show. From myself and from Brother Mahdi, we bid you assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
I am what I am because you made. I have what I have. My love is strong because you are the one I call creator, my Alpha and Omega, my protector and my maker. Because of you, in weakness I am braver, my defender and my savior, my giver and my taker. Abiding in silence with patience and guidance, aware when I need you, a light when I seek you, justice, forgiveness, the strength in my weakness, and my love is strong.
This is the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1520 to 1620 UTC on the following frequencies. 41 meters, 7,410 kilohertz for Indian subcontinent. And FM 91.5 megahertz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Heartbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or Badr 5, and via internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.